village.
What do you want?
Information.
Whose side are you on?
That would be telling. We want information. Information. Information.
You won't get it.
By hook or by crook, we will.
Who are you?
The new number two.
Who is number one?
You are number six.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in to the program. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and I am your host. Stop by our website, redicecreations.com, for much more on all and everything. It is the third Thursday of March already, can you believe it? And with us on the line, we have our monthly regular guest, Michael Tessarion. It's a pleasure to have Michael back with us on the show, and we do have an excellent program lined up for you today. We are going to spend some time talking about movies, the symbolism and the messages. We have quite a few movies lined up that we want to get to, so I think we simply should get right to it. So let's say welcome back to Michael, and at the same time just mention that the clip we played right at the beginning is of course from the very interesting 1960s TV show called The Prisoner. I am not a number, I'm a free man. How about you, Michael?
That's right. It's an excellent series. You know, people should definitely watch it because it's probably one of the most symbolic visual, you know, productions ever made, far beyond anything most people have ever come across, and certainly deals with it, you know, concept of what is freedom, and very much deals with the concept that even if you don't have freedom given to you, then you can still be free in your attitude or your mind, you know?
Yeah.
It's your thinking and your attitude that must remain free. Even if you're a prisoner in every other sense.
Sure. I mean, it seems like this is, when I'm watching the series, it seems like this is a microcosm of the real world, basically, that they're portraying there.
Yeah, it definitely is.
Hmm.
It's a very brilliant series. You know, hopefully we can get to talk about it a little bit more.
So, excellent. We have, you know, as we said, we have quite a few movies lined up that we want to talk about today, or get into rather, but we have a few recommendations, so would you want to kind of get those out of the way, so to speak, right away?
Yeah, you know, just I want to make very clear, since this is being recorded, this is not a show about Michael Tessarion's favorite movies or anything like that. You know, if we mention a movie that I actually personally have as a favorite, I'll definitely mention that, but, you know, we're talking here about the symbolic quality of very exceptional films that I think that, you know, people should know about and look into. And just we're talking again about symbol literacy generally in life, when it comes to advertisements, you see, or media or video games or even symbolism, art. It's very important for people to realize the subtextual messages that come across. And since people watch a lot of movies, and since movies are now in our day and age, you know, $1 million creations, they're in your face.
Yeah.
It's actually handy for people to watch them objectively also, like a critic, and see some amazing stuff that's, you know, being told to us through the films.
Yeah,
again, just to emphasize, you know, if we come across a favorite movie of mine, I will mention it, but that's not what this show is really about.
Sure, yeah.
As for recommendations, yeah, I've got a list. I mean, the list could be endless, but, you know, some really stand out. And when we were talking, you know, before about doing this show, I wanted to, you know, I start thinking back then of movies that I have really felt, you know, were very, very excellent and very strongly recommend people to get to see them. But the first one I'd like to really recommend is the movie Educators.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Now, this is with a K, Educator with a K.
Yeah.
And it's not widely available. You know, it was a German film. It may even have subtitles as far as I know. But it's one of the most outstanding films I've ever seen and deals with some very powerful motifs. You know, we don't really even have time to go into explaining the story, but it's about a group of kids, basically, or younger people, who really want to try and change the system. And it's about, actually, how would you really go about that, and what are the pitfalls in your consciousness and also physically, you know, that stop stop a rebellious process from taking place. So even when you've got all the passion and conviction in the world, you know, and also it goes into the question of whether you're even right. Is it right to even want to change the system, you know, to change Big Brother, to change the corporatism of our world? You may desire to do that, but is that desire even right? And then even how would you go about it? So, but it's so well done. I think it's an absolutely remarkable film. The acting is stupendous, you know, and it's, again, a low-budget, independent-style film, but it's something people must make a big effort to try and get to see, in my opinion.
Very interesting. Educators with a K.
What else we got on the list there was the recommendations?
We have, let's see, should we bring up Ridley Scott right away? Blade Runner, Kingdom of Heaven?
Yeah, Blade Runner. I mean, a lot of people have already seen that film, and it's very well known.
Sure.
But definitely go for the director's cut. Watch it multiple times. It, to me, it's one of the most outstanding movies ever made. The reason why I think it's great, and it is actually one of my favorite films, is because it sort of parallels the Frankenstein story. Lightly, obviously it doesn't deal strictly with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, but it has this Promethean, Frankensteinian ending.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, with this prodigal son coming back, and I actually believe that the acting in that film by Rutger Hauer is his best.
Yeah, I agree.
It's so moving to me. It always has been. It's very demiurgic. It's a very Gnostic film.
Certainly.
You know, without going into the whole thing about genetics and, you know, the owl of the Bohemian Grove and the Tyrell Corporation is the tyrant elves.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which you pick up in Vanilla Sky.
Sure.
The whole idea about the Ellies and the Illies. Well, there in Blade Runner you have the Tyrell Corporation, which is a fusion of two words, tyrant and el.
Yeah.
And, of course, their corporation looks like a big black pyramid.
Yeah, those are amazing, those structures, yeah.
But the whole idea just of the eternal, immortal, you know, the immortal, mortal concept, which is a huge motif in mythology. And then seeking out your creator, you know, and finding out that your creator is, in fact, a limited, you know, pretty much demonic, self-serving person.
Yeah.
Who has treated you like a sort of an object. This goes back to the whole Nephilim concept that human beings are just made, you know, as chattel.
Sure, yeah.
You know, fantastic elements in the movie.
And we have
the unicorn and stuff like that. It's just an amazing film.
Absolutely. And I remember regarding the unicorn, because there are different cuts of Blade Runner. There are the director's cut and the one that is previous to that, when he actually has the narration of Harrison Ford to it.
And I like the narration aspect.
Yeah.
It brings back the old Humphrey Bogart, you know, sort of Sam Spade or, you know...
Sure, film noir kind of...
Yeah, the film noir over narration, which I have always liked. I don't know if Ridley Scott wanted that originally, I don't remember. Was that his choice?
No, I think it wasn't, because what I've read about it, it was that the film company said that the film was too difficult, so they have to have the guy, you know, in there explain a lot of it, so...
I heard that, and I usually am against explanations, you know, I like the minimalism quality.
Sure.
But since the film was very film noir-like, it kind of worked in a way to have the dialogue. I remember now that why they put the dialogue in is because they really wanted that happy ending, you know, where they all drive out of the blackness.
Sure,
into this, you know, sort of commercial setting, where the sun is shining and there's rolling hills.
Yeah.
You know, that's nonsense. I mean, that is utter, you know, but tacked-on endings, what are known in the trade as tacked-on endings, are as old as the 1930s, you know, there wasn't even a movie from the horror genre that didn't have this unbelievably bad tacked-on ending. You know, my mind goes to the movie Boris, you know, which Boris Karloff was in, The Mummy. The great Karl Freund movie, which is, in fact, one of my all-time favorite films. It's one of the greatest movies, in my opinion, ever made. Black-and-white version of The Mummy. Is an exceptional movie to the point where it has scenes within it that are almost non-existent in other films. They've barely been paralleled, you know. It's like a great composer or a great pianist, you know, like Rachmaninoff, somebody, you know, not even been able to use the fingers, fingering style of a great composer like that. Well, this is in the same way, the genius of the people behind that movie, it's almost been so far above the heads of most other people that they haven't even bothered duplicating it.
Interesting.
You know, certain scenes with the female, for instance, the strength of the female character in there and the whole dynamic that revolves around the feminine character. You know, you have to go into Werner Herzog, you know, and Wim Wenders and other people to find any comparable type scenes to rival The Mummy. It's such a fantastic film.
Interesting.
That would definitely be one of the recommendations. What else do we have on that list?
We have Jacob's Ladder, Hellboy.
Jacob's Ladder, yeah, excellent film. Again, I like it because it's the dark side of consciousness.
Mm.
You know, beautifully, you see that I like movies like V for Vendetta and movies like that that sort of fuse and Fight Club, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I like movies that infuse a very psychological type of movie, but they're also talking about government conspiracy.
Yeah.
You know, people think, oh, it was a great movie. They don't realize that two very intriguing things have been connected there.
Yeah.
This inner problem or inner conflicts of man within his inner republic fused incredibly well with the idea that there's some, you know, sort of government apparatus working, you know, Big Brother,
sure,
whatever. And the movies that really bring that out is Jacob's Ladder and V for Vendetta and Fight Club. You know,
yeah,
those are exceptional movies from those points of view.
Yeah.
The other one you said is Hellboy. That Hellboy is definitely one of my favorite, personal favorite films.
Mm.
I don't really want to say too much about it, except that it's loaded with tarot and alchemical symbolism.
Mm.
It also deals with the understanding of the dark nature of the so-called negative emotions, especially the emotion of anger.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that people who have been following my work, where we talk about the dark side of consciousness and the new relationship that we need with the dark guardians of our own, you know, we've been conditioned to believe that our own emotions are something negative.
Mm, yeah.
Jesus, how did that ever happen? I don't know. But, well, Hellboy, to me, the subtext in that film is very, very much about that. It's also about the character Hellboy. You know, hell is not what the Christians made out. The underworld cycle, or hell, was an old Scandinavian idea where the hell was the place you went to meet your dark guardians, to embody those, to reconnect with those, to pass the tests that they have, or in Jungian terms, to actually meet the shadow.
Hmm.
Like, you know, we've been speaking also with Paul Levy about stuff like that. Well, meeting the shadow, that's what Hellboy represents, and a lot of the movie involves the underworld, going into the underworld to face, you know, entities,
yeah,
that are called daemonic or demonic. But, again, a very strong female character there,
mm-hmm,
who's been repressed by society and who's deeply repressed. A person who was so unique when she was a child and who had a free flow of her emotions and who was empowered by a good, positive relationship with her so-called negative emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Society then, of course, frowns on that, so the girl ends up in a lunatic asylum for the most of her life.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Mm. And the movie opens basically where, you know, this girl is interned, literally has been locked up because of the powers that she possesses as a young child because she didn't repress her emotions.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
the concept of the repressed female connecting with the shadow is a very, very old motif, going back past the Dracula movies,
mm,
past the, you know, the mummy horror movies, and all the way back into great literature.
Mm.
And just, you know, the movie is laced for, so for anyone who wants to deal with alchemy or psychology or Jungian psychology or whatever, you know, Hellboy is a movie that will really intrigue you. It's absolutely, yeah, multidimensional film.
Absolutely. And even, you know, you get a pinch of, you know, the connections between the Nazis and the occult in there too. I mean, that's,
oh, yeah,
fabulous.
Again,
stuff,
tying in with, you know, that there's an outward conspiracy as well.
Exactly, yeah.
And also the whole idea that Hellboy and the girl and other so-called freaks are literally being used as scientific experiments by the elite.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah,
tying into that whole Russian thing about using clairvoyance and mystics and people who can do all sorts of kinesthetics,
sure,
literally being, you know, used by think tanks. I mean, there's so many dimensions to that film, it's not even funny.
Yeah.
And people should read the book. You know, people should read the comics.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about movies like Fight Club or V for Vendetta, you know, people, I encourage them, certainly when we talk, if, you know, Lord of the Rings,
mm,
for goodness sake, go and pick up the books. Don't just believe this is all on the silver screen, you know.
Sure, sure. But who is behind Hellboy, by the way?
It was, what's his name, Giacomo, what's his name? He's now made a new movie, the Pan's Labyrinth.
Aha, I see. Okay, that's the guy. Okay, I see.
Yeah, yeah. His name is escaping me right now.
It's a Spanish.
Look it up. We can link to these movies we're talking about on the Red Eye site, right?
Yeah, absolutely, sure. We'll do that, yeah. All right, so we got some more here. 1 Hour Photo.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely amazing film. Robin Williams, probably the greatest acting he's ever done. This is a small, low-budget, independent film, 1 Hour Photo. You know, box office flop, not too many people watched it. Robin Williams pretty much, you know, he's a big-budget actor, and he took a big cut in his salary and everything to work in this movie because he believes so brilliantly in the script.
Mm-hmm.
A major critique, not just of American society, because I don't believe, there's American society and then there's corporate world globalist society.
Yeah, sure.
So even though it's set in America, it's not so much an indictment of American society as corporate society, but boy, oh boy, what a brilliant film it is, because again, it ties in the whole fantasy into reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people who live in a false, projected, corporate, you know, world that's basically manufactured, escape then into their minds. So this perfectly shows you how this person has this fantasy world that he is living in.
Yeah.
You know, that basically it's indistinguishable anymore what is reality and what is fantasy.
Mm.
But I would recommend everybody to see that film. It's a very fine film.
Mm. Yeah, I remember seeing it a few years ago, I guess. But yeah, I should return to that and view it with new eyes, I guess. Definitely.
Well, these are movies that to keep in the home. These are movies to get and watch them just to stay sane, you know. I mean, One Hour Photo, all about Schmidt, you know, with, what's his name? Maniac, what's his name?
Jack Nicholson, yeah.
Right, and American Beauty. You know, these are movies that are of a different wavelength, you know, and they're very deep. They're very profound films. So, you know, I also recommend All About Schmidt, which I also very much like, you know, as a recommendation for people, in case they missed any of these.
Then we got Wolf or Wolfen.
Yeah, Wolf is also with Jack Nicholson. It's an absolutely amazing film. You know, I'm not going to say too much more about it, except people pick up that film Wolf and watch it. It's absolutely fantastic. It deals with lycanthropy, you know, but I love the message in that film. It's also, so the subtext of that movie is about your darker emotions that connect with the animals. Remember we were talking, when we were talking about the guilt complex, about the role of nature?
Sure, yeah.
And how once we've bought into the lie of the inauthentic life, one of the symptoms of that is a very negative attitude towards nature and towards animals.
Mm-hmm.
They represent the non-egoistic world.
Hmm.
Well, Wolf is sort of that that movie that deals with that theme about, okay, you know, here we are caught within our steel concrete world, but we still have a sort of an animistic animal part of us. And rather than that being something demonic or evil or something that you want to get away from, Wolf is about, you know, the beauty of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the fact that, and Wolfen jumped to mind, the early movie Wolfen with Albert Finney, because that very much deals with that theme.
Mm-hmm.
And the message in Wolfen is that, you know, the spokesman in that movie are telling the white people, you're just pathetic. You're a joke to think that your civilization's even going to last. It's on its way out, and the wolfen, the natural, will be there, you know, millennia from now. So even though you think you can erase it, it's utterly nonsensical. So, you know, people can pick up the movie Wolfen with Albert Finney and watch this very, very good film. It's quite, people would say it's a horror movie. You know, I don't think it works like that, so there's no need to, you know, if you go into the video store and find it's under the horror section, you know, don't be put off by that, because it's actually a very fine film.
Sure, absolutely. And, of course, we have, as you mentioned before, I don't know if you want to say something more about them, but The Lord of the Rings, of course.
No, let's skip that, because we'd be here all night.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we'd have to do 10 shows just on that movie, except to emphasize the fact, again, that if people are into analyzing that film, you know, think of the tarot. Think of the tarot arcanum, the major arcana, because they're all there. Even the court cards. You know, try to look at the Lord of the Rings movie. One of the ways, what they call a hermeneutic, is to use the tarot archetypes.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So let's dive right into it. We have a few films that we want to kind of dive into more detailed, I guess. How about Superman Returns? Should we begin on that?
Well, The Prisoner first. You were playing that clip from The Prisoner.
Sure, yeah.
Again, I want to encourage people to really go and check that out. There's some clips on YouTube, but Prisoner is mostly available now on DVD.
Yeah.
Either for purchase or in video stores. So even if people just pick up the first episode, which is called Arrival, you know, and check it out. The Prisoner series opens with the same music and the same little caption, the same series of images, you know?
Yeah.
As you know, they always have the same sort of introductory storyline that opens all the prisoners. That is loaded with very, very powerful information. Like you played already one aspect of it where you hear the dialogue.
Yeah.
And just as an example, if people play this interview back and listen to that or go to The Prisoner, you'll notice that the prisoner is asking, you know, who are you? He asks basically a question to the people who seem to have, you know, captured him or whatever.
Mm.
And he's asking, who are you? Who are you? What side are you on? Right? So immediately we've got the whole idea of the political.
Yeah.
You know, the ambivalence. You think it's one side or the other. And, of course, then the Prisoner series literally shows you later on that both sides are controlled by number one.
Yeah.
You know. the very next thing that you see then, of course, or he's basically asked them then, what is it you want? And then they say, information. Mm-hmm. But here's why I'm going into this is because here's a perfect example of the double or triple meanings that overlay a particular movie or documentary or scene. It sounds very obvious that when he's saying, what do you want? And they're saying, information. That's what they want, information. But the word information is repeated four times in a very, very short sequence.
Hmm.
And the way that the voice is pronouncing the word is information. So the word takes on a double meaning. It doesn't just mean information of an intellectual type. It is actually what they're saying, emphasizing subliminally to your subconscious mind, is information.
Yeah.
That you are in formation.
Exactly.
So actually, when you get into looking at the prisoner that way, you actually discover something amazing, and that is that the opening scenes of the prisoner are about the descent of the soul into formation, into the world. That's what this man is also alluding to on a metaphysical level. Patrick McGoohan himself was an expert in 14th century manneristic and mystery plays, a medievalist, specializing in certain allegorical Christian mystery plays, which are highly complex, which also people like Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, you see, were experts in.
Yeah.
So there's more to his series and his work than people might first imagine. But again, if you step back and listen to what's being said, this whole idea of, you know, in the beginning of the scene, you hear a crash of thunder.
Yeah.
The crash of thunder and the bolt of lightning has always been a symbol for the descent of the soul into matter. Kabbalistically, and even in Christian mythology, the fall of Lucifer, the fall into matter, you see. So that's what you see. The whole prisoner opens with a crash of thunder, which is the primal cause or the first cause. From the center of the screen, which always represents basically transcendent vanishing point, you see a car coming with the prisoner, a single-seated car in which the prisoner is in. That's taken from the tarot card, the Chariot. And the Chariot tarot card represents precisely that, the descent of a soul into matter. The sign of Cancer being called the gate of the soul, in which the soul falls into matter. And you see this image in a modern rendition. And then later on, just a few seconds later, you see the descent to the underworld, where the prisoner character goes into the underworld, you know, subliminally, in order to make his resignation to the government. But the symbolism is that he goes into the underworld. When he goes into the underworld, there's an office. And in the office, there's a man sitting behind a desk with a big map of the world behind him.
Yeah.
Subliminally, that's the Demiurge again. That's a Gnostic concept of the ruler of the world. And so the prisoner or the child who's being introduced into this world that he doesn't want to be part of, he doesn't want to be imprisoned in the world of matter, he says, I resign, I'm leaving this. I want to remain a spiritual entity who's free.
Yeah.
And then what happens is the symbol of the X appears, which is highly subliminal. And the X, of course, is the cross, the crucifixion of Jesus.
Yeah.
The crucifixion of the pure one of spirit, because leaving the world of creation is not just quite a simple process. You have to go through a death experience. And the symbol of the ritual death, or the transition through the rites of passage, was always symbolized by the cross. And that's exactly what you see crossing the prisoner's own face. Just before he's filed, you see, as a resigner. And the whole show of the prisoner is about why he wanted to resign, because the world order can never understand why a spirit would want to be free. But you see the cross going over his face. Now the cross, the secondary meaning of the cross, or the X, is the feminine gene.
Yeah.
Isn't it the Y and X chromosome?
Sure, yeah.
So he's feminizing himself. This is also another very important part, that he's lost his masculinity, or at least the masculinity that represents slavery to the beast, the Eros energy that builds the civilization. The prisoner's literally regressing or retracting, and he's feminizing his energy by saying, I'm crossing myself off the list. So there's a tremendous statement there also about that, you know. And then you also have, just as he feels that he's going home to his house after his resignation in the opening scene, death appears. And the death, of course, is an image from the tarot card. Right? Then he goes inside his house, and he's put to sleep through this gas. But just as he's losing consciousness, you see the image of the tower struck with lightning, or the falling tower. They do this very subliminally, where you see these two tower blocks outside his window sort of waving, you know, or inverting or turning over. And even when he's in the city of London, you see his car circumambulating around Pall Mall, symbol of the Wheel of Fortune. So there's a whole tarot symbolism, and this whole symbolism which is implied in astrology and tarot, of the fall of the soul into matter. And as another aside, for those people who are into Patrick McGoohan himself, almost in every other movie or documentary or show or any type of show that Patrick McGoohan, the actor, has been in, he himself drops a hint of the original Prisoner series, either in the dialogue or in something he's wearing or in some other very subtle way. Probably even unknown to the people that have hired him to act.
Yeah.
So this is something to watch out for. He's in Columbo a lot. He wrote a lot of the Columbo scripts.
Oh, really?
But the man is a genius and also has made a habit of dropping little tiny, allusions mm-hmm. to his original Prisoner series in other movies that he appears in. One good example is the Clint Eastwood movie Escape from Alcatraz, in which the warden of the prison is mm-hmm. Patrick McGoohan.
Oh, really?
Right. Yeah, but right down to the clothes he'll wear or the hand gestures that he makes or some very subtle comments that the actor makes, he's always been alluding to the previous series, which is absolutely astonishing. People can check that out if they want.
Yeah, fascinating.
And they should check out Arrival, the first episode in which, you know, when the prisoner arrives in the village, which is the microcosm of the world, as you're saying, he's given three credit cards or three cards which are labeled 666 because the prisoner, of course, is number 6.
Yeah,
if you're watching very closely the first series, he's actually given three identity cards, and there's three of them, and the number 6 is written beside it. So we have the number of the beast, or the number of man. You see, it's the whole idea of corporeal existence, 666, the man falling into corporeal existence.
Yeah. Oh, fascinating. Yeah, I saw that the entire first episode was available on YouTube. I'm going to link that
We can link to it.
Yeah, excellent.
You know, but then as soon as he arrives in the village, you know, he hears this voice saying, follow the signs. You know, imagine that you're the spirit, pure, and you're coming into the world, and you hear through a megaphone, follow the sign. We'll lead you to the labor exchange. You know, the first place he has to go is to the labor exchange. Then he goes into a shop to ask for a map, you know, meaning that he wants to see the big picture.
Yeah, exactly.
And all they do is keep giving him a map of only the village.
Yeah.
Every map they have is only about the world that they know.
Exactly.
He's going, well, what about the bigger picture? What about the bigger... You know, he asks the first person he meets, which is this maid, haven't you ever questioned who runs all of this? Does it never occur to you, you know, to escape or whatever? So an absolutely brilliant movie series, which I've used many times in teaching children.
Yeah.
We've watched the whole Prisoner series, you know, and kids, I found it, the surrealism involved in it, very, very, impressive.
Do you know if the guy, the producer or director or whatever, is he behind anything else?
No, it was Lou Grade. Lou Grade's behind everything. Lou Grade was, a big, corporate owner of the channel that it was showed in, and he basically gave Patrick McGoohan full rights. Patrick McGoohan's one of the people in history to have the full rights to do basically whatever he wanted with the show. So him and, his team basically, had a lot of say in where they went to shoot it and all the other aspects of it. Patrick McGoohan was making it up as he went along. He was writing the script as they made the script.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the idea is all in his brain. There was no previous storyboard. He was basically telling and directing people what to do as they were making the thing. He was just like literally brainchilding the whole thing, or at least super directing it, what I call, channeling. You know, when people like him who work on an archetypal level, it's not quite the same thing as just an ordinary creative genius type who sits down, and storyboards everything.
Yeah.
Dealing with something much more elevated than just that.
Yeah. I can remember myself watching this when I was very young. I remember the series, and I remember when I kind of, began to hunt for it, because at the time I didn't know what it was called. I just remember seeing a few scenes from it, and what fascinates me is that there are a few movies and a few series that are like this, that they kind of resonates with you instantly, and when you get older, you kind of remember the themes, and you kind of, I had this urge to kind of go view it again. So it's definitely, for me at least, something there that is very potent. I don't know what to call it, but
well, this is what happens when something is transcending. It's been made purposely, like great art, to bypass the rational center, which is all a lot of reasons why people will not like The Prisoner or other movies like that. McGoohan is a person who knows how to bracket your conscious mind. He's dealing with archetypal symbolism that, has a humongously hypnotic and brilliant effect on your unconscious mind. And that's what, stays with you as a child. you know, very much the Doctor Who series, anything that Terry Nation, the great Terry Nation made, again, will do this, you know. And there are, of course, modern examples of this, but nothing quite as good in my mind as these earlier series that were made in the 60s and 70s. And they work on the template that they're using, the sort of the artist palette that these people are drawing on is of an archetypal nature.
Yeah.
And that is why they will last for eternity, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
Man knows that he is a prisoner. Patrick McGoohan rarely did any interviews on the Prisoner series. He refused to really talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But in one of the very few, very few interviews that he did, he basically just said a couple of lines. He basically said to this journalist, look, when you're in traffic in a car and you can't move forward and you can't move back, aren't you a prisoner? You know?
Yeah.
Because that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So basically, okay, man is a prisoner.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not in at work at the right time, you're fired. You know, so, I mean, you are a prisoner.
Yeah.
Face it.
We're prisoners on multiple levels. I mean, we are, as you say, we're corporeal beings. We are, you know, in the flesh. We can't escape that.
Undoubtedly. Mm. And the whole Prisoner series, you know, just to make it very clear for people who may not be familiar with it, is a very elaborate, highly detailed, highly symbolic analysis of all those multidimensional ways that we are enslaved, both religiously, politically, psychologically. You know, all ending in this fabulous ending episode, which is completely befuddled. Even prisoner critics, people are just befuddled about what is the meaning of the final episodes. And, you know, of course, it's absolutely tremendous. I adore the last episode and have very, very specific ideas about what he's talking about there. But again, these things should be watched in sort. First of all, they should just be watched as pure entertainment or beauty, you know.
Yeah, sure.
People shouldn't try to start analyzing it right away. You know, they should just try to absorb what the man is saying, and then slowly let it digest, pass through your own consciousness, and then come up with your own conclusions.
Mm.
So, you know,
yeah,
that's what I believe.
I totally agree, yeah.
But yeah, you were talking about Superman Returns.
I did
check that out. I mean, this was a $200 million flop in my eyes. You know, a terrible movie. I think that the first movies were far better.
Mm.
You know, I really like the third, you know, Superman movie.
Mm.
I just think they were really well made, and I also like the fact that, you know, Lex Luthor was played by Gene Hackman.
Yeah, sure.
Who really added some brilliant, brilliant aspects to that character.
Mm.
Because I often believe that the anti-hero is, if not as important, even more important than the hero.
Mm.
Even in Hollywood movies where the hero is the main deal.
Mm, yeah.
And, you know, the new actors are just horrible. I mean, it's absolutely horrible. They're useless. Totally, you know. And by the way, it's pretty much just a remake. It's sort of like a very lackluster remake of the old films.
Yeah.
You know, hardly any elements, just pure fantasy into reality nonsense, you know. So I do not recommend people watch that film. Not that they
should take
my advice, but...
Okay, how about the intro, though? Isn't this... I thought that would kind of elaborated a few, you know, a bit further on the concept or the idea of... I mean, I got this really, you know, Nephilim-type deal that this is kind of a serpent race. I remember, you know, they took the images of... oh, my God, I can't believe I don't remember his name. What's the guy called? Marlon Brando at the beginning.
Yeah.
They took the old footage from this guy, and, you know, I really got the kind of a serpent theme going there. What's your take on that?
I mean, there's no doubt about it that the whole series of Superman taken as a franchise is very much based on these powerful ancient archetypal motifs.
Mm-hmm.
They've just removed the blocks around a little bit, you know, the pieces of the jigsaw, which is what great art should do. It should take the same archetypal things and never should present it to you in exactly the same way.
Yeah.
Now, the story of Superman is brilliant. Just like the story of Batman or Spider-Man, stories are magnificent.
Sure, sure, yeah.
But the telling of the story in this latest movie, I don't think was that hot. You know, it was very lackluster, and it really appealed to this masculinized mindset, you know, which I don't like. But the fact of the S, I mean, there's many, many, many ways you can write the letter S. And the Superman S has been definitely noted to be, you know, both solar and serpentine.
Yeah, yeah.
No doubt about that. It looks like a cobra. You know, the colors red and blue are Freemasonic.
Yeah.
You know, out and out Freemasonic. The concept of the Superman is also a very Freemasonic archetypal idea,
sure,
which was picked up by, you know, Leonardo da Vinci and others, who talk about man, Uberman, you know, the idea that man has a super destiny.
Yeah.
You know, to conquer evil and all of these kinds of things.
Mm.
And part about it, you know, of course, the whole idea of crystal technology.
Yeah, sure.
And the power of the crystal is brought out very strongly in the movies, you know, and was originally. But, you know, I'm just, I don't know, I think that the previous movies worked a lot better. You know, even the contrast, the whole Superman idea is the contradiction between the Clark Kent nerd, you know, wearing his specs and being sort of this nerd, and the Superman idea.
Sure.
But that's good drama, you know, that's a really interesting set of conflict.
Yeah.
And the female, of course, who's this projector par excellence, you know, what's her name in the film, you know, Lois Lane.
Lois Lane, yeah.
Who doesn't see anything at all in front of her, you know. She can't even discern that the Clark Kent is the same as Superman. This is all about projection.
Yeah.
You know, if it's powerful, it must be fantastic, you know. This is picked up a lot, you know, that, you know, the female is basically projecting her own animus, her own king, on Superman, as the whole collective can do.
Yeah.
The collective does that. So this tie-in with the, you know, the mind of the lower female who doesn't understand and who is utterly, you know, mesmerized by the fact that this animus concept exists, you know, and then, of course, doesn't honor it within herself. She's projecting it onto Superman, you know.
Yeah.
And he's only of use because he runs around solving crime and saving people from hideous death, you know, and fighting evil, you know, all of these sort of very cliché types of things.
Sure.
That's why he's important, you know.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a kind of fascinating concept in one sense, this idea of Hollywood, because often, you know, that many of these movies has this, you know, multi-contextual contents going on there. And and often, you know, people who I think that don't are, you know, into, I mean, often in that sense, it's a bit dirty almost, you know, to kind of like Hollywood movies. But again, these are people who aren't, you know, symbol literate and can see the multiple levels in these movies, because on one level it's totally, as you say, ridiculous, but it's there's so much more behind all of this. So
well, look at the Da Vinci Code, look at you know, National Treasure, which is a movie I highly recommend everyone to see. Brilliant movies, tight, edgy, not a wasted scene, no bullshit dialogue. You know, if you watch National Treasure just as a movie making exercise, it's a phenomenal film. Fantastic dialogue, you know. It's not the usual. I mean, Hollywood's so full of wiseacre, idiotic, stupid sidelines and stupid quips. You know, utterly trashy dialogue, bad scripts. You know, and then they come out, you know, the same so-called, you know, Hollywood. So, again, you're dealing with a whole spectrum of different kinds of things.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, this is a very powerful Leviathan down there who could make intensely brilliant films.
Yeah.
You know, that are like National Treasure and the Da Vinci Code that work cinematically as fantastic films, you know, especially Hellboy and things like this. This is a new art form, just in the same way that music, songs have changed, not can change people's lives, but have changed people's lives.
Yeah, yeah.
So are movies things that will change people's lives.
Absolutely.
You know, you see people, you saw people reading the Da Vinci book, didn't you, even before the movie came out, and certainly after the movie. You know, that's a very important thing to realize.
Yeah.
Whether you like the movie or not, people who saw the movie went, hey, you know, I want to read that book, or they were reading the book, and then they maybe want to read more about the Templars, you know.
Exactly.
And they want to read the second book, or they want to go back and read even the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
Suddenly they're into something that they were never into before.
Exactly.
You know, this is remarkable. You know, the fact that you can get these, I mean, obviously, if the content is brilliant in the movie as well, that is excellent. And in the case of these movies like Da Vinci Code and National Treasure, the content is fantastic, and it does reach the whole world, and it does get people interested in some of the most fascinating subjects.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's a modern art form in the same way that, you know, Da Vinci and these people and Michelangelo and Rembrandt were painters. Well, now you've got movies which incorporate music, they incorporate drama, they incorporate art, you know, and subliminals and so many other levels. People should never, ever forget that and never take it for granted.
You know, one thing came to mind here. I mean, it's so obvious, I mean, in that sense, that we have been going through, you know, our earlier periods in history, going through these different elements, just as you say. We have been working with, you know, imagery, painting and so forth, mainly, you know, during the Renaissance in that sense. And then, of course, before that and afterwards also, of course, you know, writing, developing that, the theater and so forth. But now we have, because we haven't done movies, historically speaking, or modern history at least, been doing movies for that long. So, I mean, this is like our, you know, we are actually incorporating all of the previous, you know, art forms and actually drawing them, as you say, into one form here now.
And that's why people should not feel fed up if there is a sort of a, you know, a lot of them that are rubbish. We're in the early stages. It's what I say a lot about even, you know, the conspiracy movement.
Yeah.
Don't get pessimistic. Stay optimistic. This is the information that's only coming to light. The new technology, which I connect with the age of Aquarius and the, you know, age of Pisces, this Neptunian Uranian energy that movies are based on from an astrological point of view, is very new. And it's happening because we have greater stories to tell than even the ones that were in the past. In the past, people's consciousness didn't know about the universe as we know it right now. So their drama took on a different form. Right now, we have a different message to speak of. Or the muse working through people wants a particular, you know, medium to represent a far, far more intricate story because, you know, of our frontal lobe development and the kind of understanding and the omnidirectional, you know, plastic way that people now view the world, that we're much more objective, we're less enslaved by religion.
Yeah.
We have a higher quota of freedom and thought. Not everybody, of course, granted, but, you know, we have it.
Yeah.
And so the media of movies is representing that. The manipulation, you see, of images and the digitization. This all has a very spiritual theme behind it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can't tell certain stories. You know, and look at Lord of the Rings. You think in a million years they ever could have made that into a decent, you know, production before? Impossible.
Mm.
You know, your imagination would have done it.
Yeah.
But now we have a medium that is a much greater mirror to the imagination, and I'm all for it.
Yeah, me too, absolutely. And it's interesting that they kind of, you know, we have been developing this CG, computer graphics, and all of this, and finally, I mean, it looks really good nowadays too. I mean, it's amazing what they've done with the Lord of the Rings, the series there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And by the way, if we are, one thing I will say about Lord of the Rings is do not watch anything except the full unedited director's cut, you know, whatever they call it, you know, the uncut version, the, you know, the collector's item, and get the one that has the appendices.
Yeah.
Because you're not seeing the same movie if you watch the other stuff that they release on TV.
Yeah.
Or that's just down at the local, you know, your video store, try to make the extra effort to get the full, you know, Peter Jackson cut with the appendices, and then you're really seeing the movie because there's key scenes in that must be seen.
Yeah.
Some of them absolutely phenomenal. You know, it makes a greater sense of the movie.
Absolutely. Totally agree. Yeah, so do you want to move on in the list?
Well, yeah, The Omen, I see, was on the list. Let's not spend a lot of time on that because the remake of The Omen is basically rubbish. I would like to say that it's actually a slur on the original movies because when you do a remake, I'm not really a fan of any remakes.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say that when you make a remake, it's almost a slur on the previous actors and the previous, you know, movie who did. I mean, how could you beat Gregory Peck, you know, in the original movie?
Mm-hmm.
Or David Warden, you see, or, you know, Leo McKern and these people, they've already acted in the movie. They've given their whole, you know, energy and passion to a brilliant, brilliant story. I love The Omen stories. I think they're fantastically, you know, if you read those in a book, they're excellent. You know, even Sam Neill, his portrayals in the follow-up movies, which I really like.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are very, very well-done movies. What on earth would possess somebody to go and do an absolute scene-by-scene, lackluster remake with a kid that you'd think that the casting director just whistled out the window and went, "Hey kid, do you want to be in our movie? Hey, we're making a movie. You know, ride this scooter around and we'll film you."
Yeah, yeah.
It's so pathetic, this new actor and all the people involved in the new movie. Really horrible, really.
Mm-hmm.
Not an interesting film, you know, but I do recommend people to see the original films. I like those films. I think the stories are strong.
Mm.
Not that I believe in the religion part of it, of course, but, you know, the symbolism is, it's a very symbolically rich series of films, you know, and there's a lot to think about.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Particularly the third in the series where Damien is killed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's Sam Neill. It's very good. I want people to very much focus, if we're going to talk symbolism of the film, I want them to focus on the fact of how these are Christian, pro-Christian films, probably made and scripted by Jesuits.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important for people to realize how nature and animals are portrayed in the Christian mind think. And if you watch the Omen movie, you'll always notice that Damien, the character, is connected with Satan or the devil.
Mm, yeah, sure.
For those who've never watched it, observe how Damien is a lover of animals and is very much connected to nature, you see, whereas the so-called Christians are very much against it. So this is one of the subtexts there that I want people to focus on, which is very much found throughout the whole of Western art, is this whole ambivalence towards animals and nature and darkness and the forests and dark places and storms. forms, you know, and animals are connected with evil.
Yeah.
Watch how this programming, because we're talking about programming here, that's a big programming motif that went through all the horror movies from Salem's Lot to Poltergeist with Spielberg, and it's still a very, very prevalent theme. And it's if anything is demonic in this world, that is. And Hollywood is, and these movies are responsible for a very, very subtle form of programming over years that has demonized nature. And one of the biggest ways that people have been programmed to fear the dark and fear the night and fear the moon and owls and whatever else has been actually through the programming of quote-unquote horror movies.
Sure.
And the Omen series is a very, very good example of that, as is Salem's Lot.
You know, it seems like a reflection on the, you know, classical thing about the, you know, the Jesuit went you know, over to South America and teaching that the, you know, that the devil lived in the forests. I mean, they tried to get people afraid of again, you know, using nature or being in nature even.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, of course, people who've really looked into this, of course, are familiar with this. But I just want to emphasize it for people who are coming to this kind of subject of symbolism for the first time. It's very important to have with fresh eyes to see exactly how this is done, these dramatic devices, you know, so pay attention to that, because this has a tremendous effect on the mind, and people have embodied it.
Yeah.
People have embodied these memes and these sub-themes, meta-themes.
All right, want to move on? We have, we could get to either Fight Club or V for Vendetta?
Well, V for Vendetta follows on from just what I've been saying, that, again, psychological, very heavily psychological film on one level. You know, about the persona and about the gods of the underworld. You know, I mean, V is obviously, even the letter V is interesting. You know, it connects to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony.
Sure.
This is one of the meta themes, is the music of the movie and the fact that number five.
Yeah.
You know, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony is the rebellious symphony, the symphony of rebellion against the system. But the idea that he's disfigured, he has to wear a mask, is a very, very, you know, interesting slant on the gods of the underworld. And of course he actually does exist in a place called the Shadow Gallery. And then you have the idea of the feminine, the female person having to come in and face her shadow and be put through an incredible ordeal, which he actually takes for reality. But you know, in the story, just like in Hellboy, the female person, exactly like in Frankenstein, the original stories, and in The Mummy, very rare to find that the female actually does in fact transcend and does in fact merge with the shadow. Most movies and most art and literature, and also in real life, it's almost zero that a female ever transcends in that particular way when they happen to be going through any type of underworld experience. It's very rare for that to happen, and when it does, it usually does not come off at all. And very rarely in literature or art do you ever see it, you know, coming through to its spiritual fulfillment. Now, in Hellboy, you do see that, and also in V for Vendetta, you do see that. And this is a very powerful archetype as well. But, you know, I just love the fact that the female is called Evie. Her second name is Hamon. You know, you don't have to be an expert in symbolism to realize that Evie represents Eve, and Hamon represents Amon. The gods of the sun and the moon connected. A lot of symbolism there. The idea of that, you know, just the fact that his personal motto, V's personal motto, is "By the power of truth, I, while living, have conquered the universe." So V represents really a transcendent individual.
Yeah.
You know, a person who is, you know, of God, but in a very antisocial way, and therefore has not only been marginalized by society, but has been completely, you know, made the outsider. So it's a very outsider type of motif.
Yeah.
In that film, you know, and that, and again, the idea that, you know, first of all, I personally didn't want to see the movie, because as soon as I heard it was about Guy Fawkes, or that there was a Guy Fawkes type of symbolism involved in the film, that rang a lot of bells for me about the Jesuits, and, you know, I thought, here we go, here's another movie, you know, that's pro-Jesuit or pro, you know, this whole new wave of religion that's sweeping the world. But very quickly, you know, it was obvious that this was not about that. And it wasn't about anything to do with that. It was a far more deep analysis against corporatism, corporate America, you know, and the corporate, not corporate America, but the corporate world, and the whole dehumanization of the human race. You know?
Yeah, sure. Well, awesome. I don't know if this is essential to our discussion here, but it could be interesting if you got any take on it. Allegedly, you know, Alan Moore, the writer behind the comic book, dropped, you know, his name from the film because he didn't want to, you know, be have anything to do with it, basically, because I guess this was because he thought that the that he was, you know, his ideas and his story so forth was misrepresented here.
Well, there's multiple reasons why that would happen, and obviously one of the most biggest ones that often is very common is that they just steamroll right over you.
Mm.
They take your ideas and they do not do justice to it or don't include you in the script writing aspects.
Mm-hmm.
And then a writer would obviously, you know, I would certainly, you know, immediately fall foul of them at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or they're trying to steamroll you legally, where they're not giving you, you know, enough money or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two most obvious reasons, where it's just basically aesthetic and economic breach mm-hmm. of contract. Or they're just messing with your ideas. You know, this is what so many people, like even Patrick McGoohan, you know, have had to endure. Another reason why that might happen is because it's good publicity. When you hear sure. in the media that the author is, you know, fighting a war against the studio, that brings a lot of media attention to sell the film.
It does, yeah.
So a lot of this stuff is done as hype, and then they're all big pals later on again, you know?
Yeah.
You'll find that through the Da Vinci Code, and you know, you've got to also realize that there's an entire, elaborate, highly, you know, look at the Passion of the Christ, for instance.
Mm, yeah.
The old idea, it's anti-Semitic. No, it's not. No, the Jews love it. No, they don't. Yes, they do, you know? Well, let's talk about it, you know. That sold the movie, you know, more than anything else did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the movie actually didn't do very well in England when it first showed. It was actually, The Passion of the Christ was incredibly low at the box office in the first week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it, you know, a lot of people were saying, ah, I'm not going to bother with that.
Mm.
So they respond a lot to pump it, you know, with some kind of controversy, and they'll pull anything out of the bag.
Sure, sure.
You know, I mean, with the Omen movies, the list of controversy, oh, you know, car crashes, mysterious deaths. I mean, they went to the whole nine yards of,
yeah.
you know, there's about 26 different things that is meant to have happened to the cast, the crew, the studios, the lights, the cameras, you know, accidents happening on the road and the clock stopping at 666. You know, I mean, a lot of this is, you know, was put out.
Yeah.
So, of course, you know, how much is true and how much is, you know, hype to sell a movie?
Yeah, exactly. You know,
it's a whole study in itself.
Absolutely. One thing that comes to mind is I'm always fascinated that in many cases when, you know, you see specials about the movie or something like that, that actually the actors are the ones who are sitting, you know, being interviewed about the movie and telling things about the movie. I mean, couldn't it be that, you know, these people still are under contract and in that sense are playing a role to promote or say certain things about a movie and so forth?
Well, exactly they are, because, you know, sequels are made.
Yeah.
Interviews are made. Magazines are made. Books are written. You know, a good movie like The Omen, you know, sparks an entire industry.
Yeah.
And the last thing you want to do if you've been involved with the original production is to come along and trash it all later, going, oh, it was just some movie I was in, forget it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to happen. It's just not what, you know, dramatists do.
Yeah.
Whether the movie is good or whether it is bad, you're going to get a circulation of just, you know, trivia.
Mm.
And that's just an inevitable response, you know, when you're dealing in an Iranian mercurial medium. This is one of the things that happens.